Hey everyone, it's Philip with the Everyday Fighter Podcast, and I wanted to welcome you to this episode. Today, I am just super excited to bring this to you. This is something I've been looking forward to for the past 2 months. No kidding. I first heard our guest on another podcast, and I said, you know what? I need to talk to her more in depth about these things. And so my guest today is Dr. Megan Horn. She is a clinical psychologist, but she is also a self-defense instructor, specifically with Krav Maga. And I wanted to bring her on because I wanted to talk to her about self-defense for women, particularly to help women that have gone through some sort of trauma. She has a very unique perspective, not only because of her background in clinical psychology, helping people through the trauma in their lives, but also just the fact that she's done it. She's helped people defend themselves as a Krav Maga instructor and, you know, serving both of those populations. So super excited for you to listen in on this. This is pretty much a selfish episode for me, mainly because, you know, I've mentioned in the past, I've got four girls, and this is something that is very important to me, to have a resource like this for them. And I'm hoping that you get some insights from this, not only if you are like me, have women, girls in your life that can use this information, but just to get the interesting perspective that Dr. Horn gives us here. But before we get into the episode, I wanted to go into our episode spotlight. Today, I want to talk about Humans of New York. Now, again, they're very popular. Brandon Stanton, what he started off doing was just taking photos of 10,000 people in New York. And that was just kind of a photo project for him, but it had soon blown up into so much more than that, particularly when he started interviewing these people that he was taking pictures of. Usually he spends about an hour with them, and he takes some excerpts of the conversation and puts them in as captions on the photos that he shares. And they're just amazing vignettes of, you know, just everyday people, but really, it really hits you. But I'm a fan of what Brandon has done with Humans of New York, and if you enjoy what he's done as well, one of the things that you can do to help him and further his mission with Humans of New York, you can actually help him by going to their Patreon page. Just go to patreon.com/humansofnewyork, and there you'll be able to be a patron, not only in helping him further his mission of traveling and speaking with just everyday people all around the world and hearing their stories, sharing their stories, but it also gives you kind of a behind the scenes of what he does, his kind of mindset behind the things that he does for the website, and it also gives you a chance to contribute when he contributes to people that he might talk to. So, for example, if he speaks to a woman in New York or in Africa or somebody just in need, the Patreon allows him to give to them directly, and you can be a part of that by becoming a patron. So again, all you have to do is go to patreon.com/humansofnewyork. And with that, let's jump into the episode with Dr. Megan Horn.
So I am the product of an army family. So I was a military brat growing up, and I moved around a lot. I had a whole lot of addresses by the time I was in second grade, where I kind of landed for a good while. But I had a lot of people in my family who were like uncles who were, you know, high level black belts in Ishin Ryu and Golden Gloves boxing champions and like these very cool, impressive things, but I never got to really live in the same place as them to, you know, go train with my cool uncle or anything like that. And the closest thing I got to try when I was a kid was, I think I went to a Taekwondo class and didn't take a cup of tea. But, you know, I grew up with, but both of my parents were MPs. They were military police in the Army. And my dad, I had a lot of interesting conversations growing up with my dad. He was stationed in Germany along with us more than once. And he did some cool stuff along the lines of, he brought in what's called GSG9. It's a German counterterrorism group. They're super badass human beings. But he brought them in to train with the American military military policemen that he was in charge of. And so, you know, he and I would talk about just kind of that interesting aspect of not pure kind of competitive martial arts, but what reality-based fighting looks like and how nasty and unfair it is. And you know, he like I said, he was a military policeman, and he became one. He was actually about to be shipped off to Vietnam, but they pulled him and another guy aside and said, no, you're gonna be pigs, you're gonna be military police. And he ended up basically being security for some, I'll just say, high-level people, and was being shot at and was getting into some dangerous stuff. And so, you know, I talk about this stuff with my dad growing up. You know, I have this part of my family who are super awesome in the martial art competitive side of things. And then I'm hearing, you know, kind of this grittier side on my dad's side.
So even at that young age, like, he was having conversations with you about the things that he was experiencing?
Yeah, I mean, when I was really little, he wasn't saying anything that was, you know, super detailed. It was, you know, the older I got, and as the years went on, you know, I'd find out more about life, and I'd ask him more detailed questions about some of the stuff he experienced. And, you know, like, good example is, you know, when I was early kind of college years, and I was just starting to watch this crazy thing called UFC Now, and people are getting into the octagon, and it's just, what a bunch of savages. And my dad hated it. He hated
that. Really? Really?
He was like, yeah. And it's because he came from a kind of a different side of things, which was, do you know what it feels like to be knocked out? Do you know what it feels like to not know if help is going to come when you're in a violent encounter? He's like, I don't like this. I don't know why people choose to do this. And that, you know, that was his experience, and it was just very interesting to me. And then as I got older, you know, I moved around even more. I landed in Maryland around the DC area for a long time, and then as college years came, I moved quite a bit. I had heard about this thing called Krav Maga, but everywhere I went, it was either too far away, too expensive, not available. It just, I was getting unlucky left and right with that whole piece. And I was just really just interested in learning. But then what was happening is, once I got into graduate school for psychology, I was working in some pretty unsafe situations. I worked at Cook County Jail in Chicago. You know, I was working in that area, and, you know, I was alone in Chicago, you know, getting on the L and going around by myself in places that, you know, maybe at the time I didn't know I shouldn't be at that time. and, you know, would just start to have these realizations of, damn, I don't think I would really know what to do if somebody like grabbed me. Or, you know, we all love to have this inflated ego of, oh, I would just knock him out, or, oh, I would just this. And it's like, because I grew up having these very realistic conversations with my dad, I'm like, I don't want to assume that I'll just do that. I don't even know what that would look like or what that feels like.
Mm.
So I transfer from Chicago to Washington, D.C., where I started the doctorate program. And the very first thing I did is I worked at a place called Reentry Sanctions Center, which is dealing with, you know, violent offenders, sexual offenders, people from gangs, people who have really, really difficult drug issues and are very impulsive and very cranky because they just went through detox, and I'm having to assess groups of them at a time by myself. And security is down the hall past three or four doors, and I don't know if they can hear me if I need help. So I was getting into more and more of these scenarios. I mean, the walk to my car at that place was dangerous enough. It was right next to the max security prison. And it was just, if anyone is from the DC area, they know around RFK Stadium is not the best place to always walk around by yourself at certain times. It's just unfortunately not the safest place. And again, I was like, you know, I still haven't gone and learned anything yet. So I was living in Alexandria, Virginia at the time, and I found a gym that offered Krav Maga. I was like, time to go. Like, now or never. So I took the first class. I definitely brought a friend with me because I'm, you know, not unlike most people where I was very intimidated. You know, if you watch a class of Krav Maga, you see a whole bunch of people yelling, breathing heavy, beating the crap out of each other or pads, and it looks really painful and really difficult. You're like, I'm paying to do this. This is so this is such a strange thing. During the day, I'm trying to study psychology and how to heal people. Mm. And then I'm coming in here and beating the shit out of myself and others. So it was just kind of weird. It was a weird thing. But after that, I got kind of hooked because the instructors were willing to sit and go over scenario-based things with me. So I would say, all right, this is my scenario. I'm in a chair. I have this big wooden desk. I take all the stuff off. I got three dudes 6 foot and up outweigh me big time, and they're surrounding me, and they're between me and the door, and then that door leads to a long hallway down through another couple of doors, and that's where security is. Mm. And I'm by myself, and I'm on the third floor. So, and three of those guys have pencils. What do I do if one of them gets squirrely?
Mm. You know?
So, and they would go through that with me and show me the options I had and talk about the reality of certain things I could do to prevent being in scenarios that made it so difficult.
Mm.
So it was a different mindset. It was a different approach. And I mean, on the fitness side of things, it's a hell of a workout too. There's a lot of conditioning involved as well. So it was, that was kind of my path to Krav. And then after that, about a year after I became an instructor and have been pretty much doing that ever since, I've moved around a couple times. But I've taught in a couple different places, and that's kind of it, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's great. There's a lot of places to go there. But I want to bring it to what you just described in terms of the scenario that you painted there. I mean, that's, mm-hmm. I mean, there's scenarios in crawl classes or whatever, but you got very specific about of the one that you're talking about, and you set up for them. Was there some anxiety for you, like around those situations when you were, you know, working and you see this, that, oh my gosh, this is a reality? And okay. And is it because of just because you were exposed at a young age to what your father was mentioning to you with the things that he had seen? Or was it that there were stories you'd heard about people that were in your, you know, the person that was here before, they had this scenario happen to them? What was going on there?
So I didn't know many people necessarily in the field of psychology or clinical work who had experienced necessarily like a physical attack, like hand to hand. I had read about them before. So I knew it, you know, it's happened, but I also wasn't in a purely clinical atmosphere. I was working in a very specific center. It was 8 floors. It's called Reentry Sanctions Center. So these are people who have very high recidivism rates. Some of them were in jail between 10 to 40 times. And so they came to our center because some judge somewhere said, this is your last chance. If you don't do well after this 28-day program, maybe you need to just, you need to end up in prison or somewhere more appropriate. We just can't keep doing this thing where we let you back out, you get arrested, and the cycle continues. And because of that atmosphere, you know, I'm going based off of my clinical knowledge too, of you have a lot of people coming in there with these high recidivism rates and they've experienced a lot of trauma. There's a lot associated with that. There's people in there who they've experienced mental illness on different forms and they haven't had consistent or good treatment. So I'm dealing with an atmosphere of very high irritability. Again, many of them had to go through detox before they even walk into the room to meet with me. And that makes anyone grumpy when you're detoxing off of PCP and cocaine and all of these other crazy substances. That has an effect on your brain. Some of them are coming in with, they had been shot in the head and they have untreated traumatic brain injuries. You want to talk about, I don't know what their impulsivity looks like or their emotional reactivity. I don't know. So it was a big time atmosphere of kind of anything can happen.
Wow.
And I don't know what to do. I truly, you know, I can feel aggressive and confident and all these, you know, kind of cutesy things, but it doesn't mean I know what to do if a guy that's bigger than me, you know, in his mind finds me a threat or wants to hurt me, and then what? Oh, no, I'm in mental health. You don't want to do that. You know, it's you don't know what you're going to work with. And I had one or two individuals when I was there for a short time saying some really aggressive things towards me. And, you know, I'm just kind of sitting there like, if they wanted to, they could haul off and hit me or grab me, or security's not standing right there. It would take them possibly 30 seconds, if not up to a minute or two, to get in this room. And anybody who knows anything about real aggression or violence, a whole lot can happen in 10 seconds, let alone 30 seconds or a minute or two. So it was just more of the, even though I didn't know personally a lot of people who had dealt with physical attack in that kind of scenario, I was in a forensic criminal justice type setting. And I'm dealing with unfortunately, people who hadn't been treated for different mental illnesses, substance abuse, trauma, traumatic brain injury, psychosis. Like that's a pretty, that can be a pretty chaotic atmosphere.
Just in and of itself, the environment lent itself to having these feelings of like, wow, you got to think about that. You didn't need a reference point to think about, oh, what about this? What about that? You know, if this happens, like, no, this is reality that
This is a possibility. Yes.
Okay.
Right. And I think because, you know, I don't want to paint my picture that, you know, my parents created a paranoid individual, but I think it was just more, I viewed the world in a little bit of a different way. Not that everyone was evil, but I also wasn't on the other side that I unfortunately see a lot of people of, well, you know, everyone's naturally good hearted and they mean well. And, you know, I'll be fine. Like, no one would hurt me in A, B, and C scenario. I don't think that would happen. And I don't think that way. So I just wanted, I felt like a long time ago, the more prepared I felt, the more peace I would walk around with. Mm. That it wouldn't be a paranoid state. The more I knew, the more peace I would feel. So yeah, who doesn't want that?
Yeah. So at that point, I mean, like the stars kind of aligned in terms of, okay, this is now the right moment for me to pursue some training in terms of self.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. You know, I just, like when I was in Chicago, I definitely was thinking about it, but due to my schedule and all that fun stuff that comes with being a grad student, you know, I was working, going to class, doing all of this stuff, and it didn't align with where I think I had found one or two gyms at the time, and they were way too far away. They were way too expensive, and it just didn't work. So when I was in Virginia, going to class and working in DC and come back, I just Googled the right way that one day and found this place, and they had a special going on, and I'm like, yeah, it'd be dumb for me to say no at this point. I got to do it right now. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Particularly when you're feeling that stress in your, you know, day-to-day life, there's gotta be like some way to find some relief, right? You're looking for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And what's interesting about that too is, anyone who's ever been to any sort of grad school for like psychology or social work or counseling, the term self-care is just beaten into your head, like ferociously. Make sure self-care, make sure you take care of yourself so that you do well, you know, in the other parts of your life. And, you know, when you're talking about clinical psychology and counseling and therapy and helping people, you know, it lends itself to a crowd that is not so aggressive. you know, a lot of these types of people they're lovely people, but, you know, we would talk about, well, you know, on a stressful day, maybe you take up painting or maybe some cooking or, you know, so get that yoga. Like, so it was all, and those are all lovely things that I love to do, all of those, but there was still a piece that I was like, yeah, the stress isn't being fully relieved by the yoga stretches and cooking. Like, I love those things, but it's not. And so when I would go in to Krav and just absolutely train till I can't walk for an hour or two, it was a different type of stress relief. It was a different kind of self-care completely. And it was kind of revolutionary at the time.
Well, when you mentioned that though, I mean, people would hear, you know, you were just exhausted. You spent, you know, you were just, you know, spent and left it all on the mat.
Yeah.
Was it just about the physical exertion? Because some people could say, well, couldn't you just get that from a spin class? Or was there something else?
Oh, there is absolutely something else. We probably wouldn't be talking if it wasn't something else, right? you know, when you're talking about martial arts or Krav Maga or reality self-defense, whatever you want to call it, there's arguments on many other podcasts about that in and of itself. but yeah, like I've done CrossFit. I've done, you know, any sort of related workout where you're just beating yourself into the ground and exhausting yourself. But do I get this same effect from those? Absolutely not. Absolutely. And I'm speaking for myself. But yeah, I would go into a Krav class, and it's not just realizing you're stronger than you think. It's not just realizing when you feel like you're going to pass out, what you start to learn is you have more left in the tank because of pure adrenaline and just will to keep going. When normally, if you're quote unquote just working out, you're like, no, I'm tired, I'm done. Like I did the 12 reps, I'm good. Whereas this was an atmosphere that it wasn't about counts. It was about pushing yourself past the breaking point to see what you're capable of when you're already stressed and spent. Because the idea behind that in Krav Maga, the reason why stress drills are such a focal component is if I go in to a fight purely, you know, just refreshed and ready, and I know my opponent and I have my favorite shoes on and we're on great ground and, you know, the temperature's just right and I had a great breakfast and like all these things are aligning that make it something you would charge in to do, that's one thing. But when you're talking about reality-based, just self-defense of, I could be walking somewhere holding a bunch of grocery bags, or I'm at a party and somebody gets way, way, way too, you know, belligerent and aggressive, I didn't plan any of that. So now I'm not ready. I'm not expecting it. And when you get that fight or flight type of response of, oh crap, I didn't see this coming, and now I'm scared for my safety or my life, you get a massive adrenaline dump. There's so many things going on in your brain and your body that prime it to defend itself, but it doesn't feel good. You don't feel refreshed. you know, you go downhill very quickly, but that's realistically when you would have to do something. So in order to replicate that and even know what that feels like to as close as we can, in Krav Maga, we create these stress-based scenarios. So, you know, when I'm getting my students ready, I'm going to smoke you first, whether that's running or whatever other exercises, flurry punches, kicks, I am going to smoke you to the point that you feel like you're done working out. Then you're going to go work with some of your colleagues or your peers, and they're going to choke you and they're going to bear hug you. And then when you think you've just gotten out of that one, someone's coming in for a takedown and you have to deal with being on the ground. And then you have to realize, oh, he has friends. What do you do when someone's coming at you while you're on the ground? What if someone has a weapon? So it's a very different, it's very frenzied, it's very chaotic, it's horribly frustrating. All things that when I'm in the midst of it, it's always, why do I do this? Why do I don't like this. this is not enjoyable. I don't like this. But that moment that you survive it and you keep going, you're like, holy shit, I didn't realize I could get through even that much. And it just builds over time. So it's a different, and please understand, I'm not putting down, you know, kind of traditional workouts of like barbell weightlifting and stuff. I do that stuff every week and I love it for its own reasons, but that is not enough for me. I need to do some sort of Krav training, in order to feel like there's improvement and it's a reminder of what I'm capable of at kind of a more primal level, if that makes sense.
No, absolutely. Yeah. Well, because you know, talking about in terms of like a self-care, it seems like it's not necessarily in and of itself, like the self-care wouldn't be the entree point into Krav Maga Yet it does, but it does give you that though. There's that it's not, you know, it's not just about the techniques, the self-defense and all that kind of stuff. You are, I mean, in a lot of different ways, if you're training in that, you are getting self-care, even though that might not be the way necessarily people are entering into it. I want to.
Oh, 100%, and yeah. And it's funny.
Yeah, yeah. I want to ask you a little bit about, like, you mentioned growing up and being exposed to two worlds in the fight world. So you mentioned had some badasses on, you know, part of your family, and then you were exposed to, you know, your parents, primarily your father, as far as like the kind of quote unquote reality based stuff. What was that like for you? Because they can be a bit feel like, you know, even though we, you know, from the outside looking in, it's just all just fighting, right? But then when you spend some time in there and you hear a little bit more about each side, it can almost look like they're opposing. So what was that like for you in that?
in what sense?
I mean, just like kind of processing it, like maybe even just placing value, not necessarily all in like choosing sides, but like kind of choosing what you chose to, or choosing what to take from one side or another, if there were, you know, kind of sides.
Yeah, I mean, so like I said, at being a military brat, I didn't get the fortune of, you know, living around these family members who were these martial art badasses. I got to see, you know, videos, or they'd show me a little something if I visited. But I really, other than that, I didn't get a whole lot into it. It was just something I had interest in, but just didn't really go that route. And, you know, as a kid and a teenager, I got into other sports and other activities. I was on dance team for a long time, so I was a dancer. I grew up riding and training horses, so that was super awesome. And I did other things like, you know, play soccer or softball, run track, you know, play lacrosse. Like, I would participate in these other sports, but it wasn't until, you know, I got into Krav Maga, you know, I got into that for a very specific reason. Like I said, I was in these scenarios, I don't know what I'm going to do. And when I researched Krav Maga myself, I'm like, yeah, this is exactly what I'm looking for, is a very direct approach.
Gotcha.
And I liked the aspect of these other martial arts where, you know, there's a culture around it. There's a deep history around a lot of these traditional Eastern martial arts. You know, I looked up like Ishin Ryu and Kung Fu, and, you know, and then I actually started learning more about martial arts when I started taking Krav, because I would be in a gym and I'd look over at another class and I'm like, what are they doing? And they're like, that's Muay Thai. I'm like, that shit's awesome. Like, that's cool. You know, they kick like they're about to chop a tree down. And so, you know, then it would go into, and this can be dependent on your instructor too. I got lucky in this sense of my instructor was very good with Muay Thai striking. And so I learned, you know, really good round kicks and how to utilize some of these motions that Muay Thai practitioners use, but do it with a more dirty street type of mentality of like, man, what I can do with my shin against someone is phenomenal. Now let's take it into the non-competitive atmosphere and imagine what I can do with my shin when it's directed towards the groin.
Mm.
Right. So that's not competitive. That's not fair. That's not cool, bro, to do a groin strike. But because I was so focused on, I'm tall for a female, but I'm not big. Mm. I don't have big muscles. I'm not innately super strong. I need to figure out how to use my body in a way that's so devastating that I hopefully end a fight sooner.
Mm.
So I need to go with the most vicious parts of my body. And so I would start learning, like these certain things I would learn in Krav. I'm like, where does that come from? Well, you know, this strike and this strike, that really has its roots in Muay Thai.
Mm.
Oh, cool, cool. And then we would go to some of the groundwork portions. You know, this is very wrestling based. This is very Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu based, but you turn the volume up, you take the competitive piece out, and you shift the mindset.
Mm.
So, you know, I've done BJJ training, and, you know, because I did Krav first and then BJJ, I'm a super annoying student. you know, I'm like, well, why are you teaching me to pull guard? Like, that's awful. I would never in my heels and jeans on cement pull guard. That is awful. and you know, this is when I'm starting out, like, this is such a horrible, horrible idea. But you know, because I did Krav and then I started learning about these different pieces, I then started cross training in some of these more, you know, traditional competitive based martial arts.
Mm.
And let me just put it this way, because what you're asking, like I said, people do podcasts and write articles and do very, very aggressive bitching sessions online about it.
Yes.
Like, there are MMA people out there who hate the reality-based self-defense people, who hate this group and hate that. And I'm kind of back here going on my psychologist roots of, you're all missing the point.
Mm.
It's about context.
Mm.
So am I wrong to cross train in traditional Muay Thai striking and to go into a BJJ class when they're not, you know, pure reality based? Well, that's my voice. That's my context. That's how I want to learn.
Yes.
So yeah, it just, it kind of depends. And that was my route. I know a lot of people who, like, I've had a lot of Krav students who, I've had a ton of Taekwondo students come in and they're like, yeah, I'm a black belt in Taekwondo. And, you know, they have a really hard time doing level one Krav stuff.
Mm.
That's not to down Taekwondo, but it's a different context. It's
yes.
Different mentality. And there has to be an adaptation there. And there has to be a willingness to explore that. And I think people in martial arts, whether you're talking about traditional or self-defense, reality-based, whatever, everybody gets very territorial and stuck.
Sure.
And because I like this territory, I'm going to assume that yours sucks and yours is wrong and you're infringing upon mine.
Yes.
And it's, again, I'm like, you guys are missing the point.
It becomes more of like a kind of a,
it all has a turf war.
You know, it's like the Jets and the Sharks, yes. Going at it, kind of a thing, right?
You know.
So, I hear you there. It's West Side Story
out in martial arts right now.
Well, yeah. Without, sometimes with pirouette, sometimes not. You know, but you know,
I snap things, either way. Just toss a snap.
I'm trying to get, I've got the picture in my head now. That's so funny. One of the things you just mentioned, it was really, it put the picture in my head of, like, when you're talking about them saying you got to pull guard, right? And you're thinking from your point of view, your context, okay, I'm in high heels, I'm in this, in that, you know, it's a lot of it,
it's not put, or it stays too much in kind of one context sometimes. And sure. Like, you know, that's where, like, you know, they kind of like build their chops, so to speak. But, you know, you were thinking of it, especially coming from, you know, that work environment that you had. It's like, how can I use this in this situation?
Right.
Now, I want to go a little bit back there in that you're in this situation, this work environment. Was there anything that was given to you in terms of preparation or training from your employers to be in that environment?
God, no. No, not at all. Not in the least. About the most you would get, you would get a very false sense of security because they did have a security team in that building.
Mm.
And they were all great people. My memory of them is they were all lovely, great people that I'm sure if they were standing right next to me, you know, they'd do a bang up job. But the reality was I was put into a lot of scenarios where, you know, it's very clear someone with a different mindset planned it.
Mm.
And that mindset is one of denial. Like having any sort of martial arts background or even law enforcement, military, where, you know, you're not assuming that everyone's out to kill you, but you also know what people are capable of, particularly when you're in an environment where they're unpredictable.
Mm.
And I was in a very unpredictable environment. Quite frankly, it was predictable in its unpredictability of, I know on a day-to-day basis, somebody could just kind of have a bad day. They could have a flashback. They could not be finished detoxing. Mm. You know, anything could happen. Someone could have a traumatic brain injury and I said something wrong or looked at them wrong. And it doesn't have to make sense to anyone else. It just has to trigger them in a certain way.
Mm.
And again, like that scenario I told you, I am in a tiny room. My back is to a window and I'm on the second or third floor.
Mm.
Let's see, a huge desk is between me and three men. All of them were 6 foot and taller. Actually, one of them I remember was about 6'6". He was big boy. And they all outweighed me significantly. All three of these men are blocking the door.
Mm.
All three of these men have a pencil. Behind that door is that long hallway with multiple other doors. And security is past that point.
Mm.
So even if I got the opportunity to scream, that's still a significant amount of time for them to get to my door or figure out which door that noise came from.
Mm.
So there was very much a, you know, if you don't feel safe, just leave the situation and go get someone. And that's all fine and good.
Okay.
That's a lovely sentiment, but that's not, you know, every year that goes by and the more I train and research and speak with people and learn, like that is the exact type of scenario where you are far too late.
Mm.
You didn't prevent, you used no preventative measures at all.
Mm.
Other than just having security in the building. That was as far as it went.
Mm.
So even after my first or second Krav class, I went and told them as my own preventative measure of self-defense for me, I said, with all due respect, I refuse to do individual testing in my office anymore.
Mm.
It has to be in the group room, which was a big open door. It was at the end of the hallway. Mm. It was a different... It allowed me more opportunity to either escape or be heard.
Mm.
So even if those were the only couple of things I could shift, I did it because it was there to shift.
Mm.
So yeah, sorry. That's why I kept laughing. Cause I'm thinking, no, they didn't prep me.
I think that's the thing. It's like, you know, from just having this conversation, right, and from some people that are listening to this, like, oh yeah, you know, that's a fair question. She, you know, that it makes sense. Of course, she's going to say yes. They gave her some kind of a thing, but even if it was like a half hour, whatever. But that that wasn't even the case.
No, not at all.
So, I mean, we talked about context, definitely, in terms of that's very important. Talked about there is a bit of denial, maybe some would call it willful ignorance to particular situations, right? I mean,
that's
that's
a very nice reframe. Yeah.
I'm not trying to piss anybody off, but I want to be sure that the message gets through. And then what you just talked about there in terms of like, you had some knowledge as far as, you know, even like after one or two sessions of Krav that you spoke up. So for me, a lot of that, I mean, leads me to like, you know, really what I wanted to kind of pick your brain about is this, all those three things kind of play into self-defense for women, quite frankly. I mean, it's like, that's one thing, at least for me as an instructor myself, and as someone that wants to be able to serve whatever population, but particularly, I'm a dude. So I'm not coming from that point of view. What is your point of view when it comes to self-defense for women in any context? I know that's a fairly broad question to ask, but I mean,
I could write books on that. Yeah.
Well, no, absolutely. But I think, we got to start somewhere. And I think, for you, what's the first, where does it make sense to start with that?
So like right now I teach a course, at a college near me, Purdue of Fort Wayne, and it's my third time doing it, and it's women's only self-defense. And one of the things I have really focused on, and I've gotten luckily very good feedback on, is the way I approach women versus if I had a male only or combination male female type of crowd is I have to understand my population. I have to understand my client, so to speak. Mm. Can't take the psychologist out of the girl.
That lends that lends to this conversation though, right? Because there's definitely psychological aspects of it. It's not all about technique. It's not all about physical, exertion, right?
Yes. So I'm kind of going to backtrack before I get back to the women's college course I'm doing right now. So how I got to the point where I am focused in a different way with women now is because when I started in Krav Maga, they're like any martial art or fitness craze or what have you, whatever service is offered out there, there's always going to be people who get a little funny and overly ambitious with their marketing. So, I would hear and be told constantly when I started out in Krav Maga, it doesn't matter if you're a man or a woman, it doesn't matter if you're tall or short or how much you weigh or how strong you are, it doesn't matter. Everyone's capable of X, Y, and Z. So of course, entering in, I'm like, that's a really nice thought, but I don't know how much I buy it. Mm. But regardless, that is what I was constantly hearing.
Mm.
So, and even when I was in classes with men and I was always in the small percentage, if not by myself as a female, I'm training with these guys that most of the time, I'd say 95% of the time, they're bigger than me. They outweigh me. Whether they're taller or shorter, they outweigh me. There's more muscle mass. They're stronger than me. As I started excelling, becoming more experienced, going up in the levels, there were just certain times where even as I got stronger and I would work out and start lifting weights and, you know, all of this stuff, is there were certain movements for me that didn't work very well.
Mm.
And, you know, in the beginning, I'm like, well, that's my problem, I guess. Like, because they're saying this should work for everyone because of the body mechanics behind it. And I'm like, but I'm doing exactly what you're telling me. And I would have black belts monitor me, see I'm doing what you're telling me, but you're not able to give me any other advice on how to make this exact movement work.
Mm.
So whether it was a weapons defense and retention movement or something on the ground or a takedown or whatever, there were just these little spots that just didn't work for me.
Mm.
And so, you know, I'm not one to throw the baby out with the bathwater and say, well, screw Krav.
Right. Sure.
Because these couple of things don't work, because the rest of it was beautiful. So, you know, just the more I started cross training and the more I started this and that, and just kind of removing myself and getting some space and teaching on my own versus directly under some people, you know, I listened to my own voice.
Mm.
And I was like, you know, these certain movements don't work because guess what? Weight and strength matter. This movement for me against a bigger person, even if I do proper technique, this particular movement won't work for me because they're stronger and bigger than me. Mm. And that mass will work against me.
Mm.
So, again, I'm not going to throw the baby out with the bathwater. I'm going to adjust, though.
Hmm.
And as I start doing this over time of learning, you know, that adjustments are available, and it doesn't mean that you're not doing that particular system anymore. It's just, it's realistic modification, right? Hmm. Like, it just made more sense. And then the more I get into teach and see women have difficulty with certain areas that I even saw myself having earlier on, I'm like, ooh, there's a pattern here. And, you know, another big thing that came up for me was, you know, I can go and I probably talked about this on the other podcast that you listened to, but you know, I can go into a room full of male students, range of ages, doesn't matter, and I can say, get with a partner, get a tombstone pad, and you beat the shit out of it with everything you've got until I yell time.
Mm.
Guess what I'm probably not going to have to say twice?
Mm.
I'm not going to have to say, go harder, be more aggressive, like, bring it out in you.
Yes.
Because men usually are socialized that way.
Mm.
It's more appropriate from toddlerhood and up for men to express a level of aggression. And I don't mean all of it negatively, but a level of confidence, a level of aggression, physical aspects. These are things that men are more apt to do because it's encouraged.
Mm.
And then you look at the other side of the coin where I get a group full of women in a seminar. None of these women have ever done martial arts, but you know what? They paid to come into this seminar. They want to learn how to be, you know, Jennifer Lopez from Enough, and they're ready to go.
Yeah.
But guess what I have to do every single time I put them in that same scenario? I have to do double, triple duty around the room and tell these women, stop apologizing to your partner for hitting the pad and possibly making them uncomfortable.
Mm.
It's okay. I want you to yell. I want you to hit that pad so hard that it rocks your partner back.
Mm.
This is a good thing. Yell at them, push them, put their back to the wall, keep going. And it takes more time with women. So of course, you know, again, I'm like, I see a pattern here. Why is there such a difference between my female and male students? It's not because of psychological weakness per se, or a difference in the genders of wanting to learn or ability to learn. It's we're socialized different. How many women do you know that have told you stories of a guy getting aggressive with them at a party or a bar or somewhere because they just didn't want to give them their number or dance with them or talk? And they will do whatever it takes to make that guy comfortable. I'll just lie to him and say that my boyfriend's here, because he'll respect the fact that an imaginary male is in proximity versus the fact that I say no thank you. So there is a difference there of we are socialized typically, you know, I'm generalizing here, but you know, we're taught to care for people. We're taught to make other people comfortable, become mothers, become family providers, and, you know, be nice. You don't want to, be too aggressive, or don't be a bitch. You know, it's, we're given very different messages from birth. So do you think that 3-hour seminar that I'm going to erase that?
Right.
Absolutely not.
Right.
So it's just a different process with women. So come back to the college course I'm doing. I incorporate some pieces of lecture, and I incorporate education and a space to just allow them to experience this for the first time. So it's more of, you know, opening a door to these women, not because I have to treat women differently than men because they're innately unable to learn certain things. It has nothing to do with that. It's some of these women coming in 17 years old, 25, 40, 55, and they're almost looking at me like, I don't want to hurt my partner. And so I go through a different process with them of it. I don't want to say it's giving these women the ability to give themselves permission, but for lack of a better, you know, way of explaining it, it's you are worth beating the shit out of that pad, getting some bruises on your knuckles, having your partner accidentally hit you, and realize, holy shit, I'm still okay. Like I'm stronger than I thought. Wow. You know, like when women hold the tombstone pads, like against their chests for people to punch and flurry. I have been to plenty of gyms where they will allow women to hold it a different way because it hurts their chest. And, you know, I have the advantage of being a female instructor, so I can utilize more casual, humorous language behind closed doors with women to say, they're not going to break. You're going to be okay. And you have to understand that in a realistic scenario, that if you fall apart the first moment you feel pain, you've already lost. And this is our opportunity to introduce you to a new way of experiencing pain, and that it doesn't own you. It doesn't rule you, and it's not something to always run away from. Like, you are so beyond capable of taking a hit, wiping the sweat or blood, getting a big smile on your face and saying, all right, my turn. Like, I am worth harming someone else for my own safety or my child or my friend or my mother. It's worth it to me. So yeah, the long-winded answer of how I approach women differently. And, you know, one of the things I tell my women, my female students, when I start these like college courses, I've done like these series, you know, I come in and I, you know, we sit around the little campfire in the classroom and I'm like, look, if you need to understand something, you walking into this classroom means that you are interested and willing to protect yourself at any cost.
Mm.
But before you do that, you have to emotionally know that you're worth doing that.
Mm. Hmm.
And, you know, to go back to the self-care piece we talked about, it, you know, you turn on any channel, you know, on American television or YouTube video or radio, whatever you want to say.
Mm.
The biggest message with women is take some time for yourself. Go get a bubble bath. Like, go get your nails done. Go get your hair done. Go get martinis with your girlfriends and treat yourself. Like that. Now, God knows I love doing all of those. But that is what female self-care has been viewed as. Of, if you feel prettier, you'll feel better. You do these kind of simplistic things, you'll feel better, which to a certain degree, they absolutely do.
Yes.
But I'm coming at a different angle of, I'm going to take care of myself to the point that not only does my hair look great, I went and got my highlights refreshed, like I have my favorite, you know, lipstick on, I'm good to go. But if somebody grabs me and tries to rip me into a car, I'm ending them.
Yes.
And if they end me, I will leave the evidence that I fought to 120% of my ability, because I'm worth protecting. The life I lead and who I am as a person is worth that fight. Mm. That's a level of self-care that I can't ignore. Mm. So I, you know, when I talk to women about it in that respect, I'm like, yeah, yes, girl, go get your nails done. Go get your hair done. Like, of course.
Mm.
Do you know how to protect yourself even verbally if someone comes around?
Mm.
Do you know how to avoid certain scenarios so that you don't even have to be in that situation? Mm. Like, self-care at its most at its most primal level. And that's what's being ignored.
Mm.
But God forbid we don't have our nails done.
Hmm.
Right?
No. Jesus Christ.
But yeah, I mean, anyone who is trained with me or knows me, like, yeah, I always have some sort of makeup on, or, you know, I get my hair done and I like certain leggings, and yeah, there's nothing wrong with being feminine and doing these things that I normally like to do.
Hmm.
But you're damn right that when I go into a training, that it's about learning how to protect myself and my life.
Mm.
And that's the highest level of self-care that I can think of.
Is this something that you feel, and I want to be respectful of your time, we're got past the hour here, but tell me to quit anytime. But I think this is way too important. I don't want to leave it. I don't, because there are, like, I get emotional about this because I got four girls, right? And at the same time, I work with people there that have been through trauma. And I feel horrible because I don't know these things, because I'm not a woman, because I haven't been socialized that way, et cetera. Short, and here's the reality. In terms of martial arts, self-defense, whatever you want to call it, primarily it's men, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Like, it's made up. Population-wise, in terms of instructors, et cetera, it's mostly men there that are, you know, teaching. Definitely there are the women such as you that are doing it. Short of cloning you and dropping you by parachute in major metropolitan areas, is this something, is this message something that can come from a man?
Mm. That's a very good question. I feel absolutely it can.
Hmm.
Now, with that being said, with great caution,
hmm.
I see way, way, way too many male instructors regurgitate information to women that they just kind of wrap it in a new package from what they already teach them of, you know, do these movements and you'll be fine. And I think, you know, I've had this conversation with multiple people in the past when it comes to martial arts who, you know, they're very interested in other areas. So, for example, like Buck, you know, Buck is super interested in things like outside of martial arts. He's very interested in like philosophy, and, you know, we get into conversations about like neuroscience and how that affects martial arts and trauma. And, you know, these are all worlds converging in the same universe. But what ends up happening is you will have some, you know, don't want to generalize too much. I don't want to hear people yelling at me because I'm not going to listen. Doing the work to present the most valuable information in to their popular client. And so, like what I was saying before, I'm approaching women from a different stance because of through a lot of trial and error, education, experience, professional and personal. I did not teach women's seminars because I'm like, well, I'm a chick. I can do this. If that is your foundation for being a women's self-defense instructor, my, you know, some of my prior female students could teach after taking one class. They're female. They've hit a pad. Okay. I can teach.
Fair enough.
That's not enough.
Right.
So, like I said, can male instructors be effective, good women self-defense instructors? 100%. There's no reason. However, what I see is that they basically just transfer knowledge and approach women, and they put some cute girl on a flyer in heels and a stupid pose, and they're like, oh yeah, come learn how to be a badass. And it's like, what have you done to prepare yourself to be this kind of expert? So have you had years of teaching women? Okay, that's a good start. Okay. How many female instructors have you interviewed or worked with personally? Okay. How much research have you done into what the actual statistics are of who attacks women? So the reason I bring up that little tidbit, I see so many classes and seminars of these male instructors. You know, some female instructors have been suspect of this as well, but you know, some of the movements, some of the self-defense movements and scenarios they're going over, I'm just looking at it like, what are you preparing them for? The majority of attacks, the majority of violent and physical attacks against women happen by someone they know. So if you're going to spend this 3-hour seminar causing paranoia and teaching them how to deal with the boogeyman wearing a hoodie that jumps out of a jogging trail, man, man, you're teaching them how to defend against a small percentage of what women actually experience. So right now you're telling me you're not fully educated. So would you want to get mental health services from somebody who just kind of read one or two books and said, well, my friends tell me their problems.
Right.
They told me I'm a good listener. Does that put them on the same level as a psychologist who has spent an ungodly amount of time studying and applying their work and doing research and consulting and all of these other areas, you have the right as a consumer and a student to say, what makes you qualified to teach me? Right? So, you know, when you go into these MMA gyms and you have a guy teaching a class and you're like, well, what's your background? What makes you good enough to teach this class? How many professional fights have you been in? Well, I haven't yet. The hell do you know then? Right? And I'm not saying you have to have been in these nasty fights to experience some of this, but I just think when you're dealing with a population that has a different need, meaning women's self-defense versus men's, the statistics and the reality of what men experience violence-wise versus women is different. It is. Is there overlap? Of course. Human violence is human violence, but it's directed in particular ways dependent upon who the target is. So, yeah, when I teach my female students, one of the first things I tell them is, everything I teach you, I have taught my male students before. But I just might not focus on it with them for a long time. So am I going to focus on hair grabs and pulls with my male students? You know, if I get that random dude wearing a man bun, okay, you know, sure. Come here. I'll show you some some hair pull defenses. But that's not going to be the main reality.
Right.
So, yeah, it's context, and, you know, it is like in psychology. I am required by an ethical board and state laws of what I have to know, have continuing education, the degrees I already have to have. Like, there are places that are set to let the public know I'm not a threat to you. I am here to help you because I have all of these experiences that show my competency. And when we go into self-defense, because somebody makes a really cool flyer or some, you know, sweet editing on their YouTube video with some, you know, some cool music, and, you know, they get people to demo some movements with a lot of cutting and angles, and, you know, it looks cool. Okay, but where's your competency? What's your background?
Right.
Tell me what makes you qualified to be an effective, like, good instructor towards this population. So, hope that makes sense.
No, absolutely. Last thing before I let you go. Reality is part of this as well, is that many women, whether they go specifically to a seminar that is marketed women's self-defense, or they just go into the gym, right? Chances, there's a good chance that a lot those folks have experienced trauma in the past.
Okay.
And in terms of, like, you got a unique you got a unique perspective on this already because of your training in both worlds, right? What's the way to approach that?
Oh, geez. I've had some people approach me about this, and it's one of those areas where, like, some black belts and Krav Maga contact me of interested in teaching my instructors. Signs of trauma are that could come up in our classroom, and how our instructors could attend to students in an appropriate, healthy way. Because that's not anyone who's ever been through Krav Maga instructor certification course or any other self-defense or martial art course where you're becoming an instructor. That's not a focus, not one I've ever seen.
Right.
Quite frankly, there's an instructor course I went through where I had to actively help someone who was going through a flashback And you had all of these upper level, amazing people, and God love them. Like they meant no harm. They didn't know what to do. Dropped in a position screaming, and they're like, shit, Megan, you know, Megan, so I came in and, I was still in grad school at the time, but I knew enough to help this person reorient back to their surroundings and to, kind of de-escalate and calm down. That's not common sense.
Mm.
That could just look like somebody having a little bit of a bad day to somebody and they're like, we'll just leave them alone. They're fine.
Right.
Or they're trying to overactively, just everybody sit around her and say, hey, are you okay? Are you okay? While she is screaming and not in the room anymore up here.
Yes.
So yeah, I've had that asked of me before. I haven't actively chosen to do it yet. It's something I'm interested in doing, but it's a very interesting thing to think about because of what you just said. A lot of people who go into self-defense, there's a good chunk of them who they've been through some shit, right? And something, if they have some sort of like post-traumatic stress, and something could come up in class, they could be triggered, they could be re-traumatized. And dependent upon the person, you don't know what that consequence is going to look like. And so, when I've had instructors or even demo partners with me, I let them know to come get me, to not push the person, to make sure that whatever it takes, they feel safe.
Mm.
Mm. And so, when you're in... You go to a gym, you're in a Krav class, there's 20, 30 people and everybody's going hard and it's very boot camp-esque, right? And that's lovely for a lot of people. That's what they went there for. They feel accomplished, they learn, they get a great workout. But for that person who could have experienced like a re-traumatization of that experience, you can't boot camp them through it.
Mm.
That it doesn't work that way.
Yes.
You could essentially make their presentation worse. So it's just about knowing what that looks like and how to approach it. So this goes back to what we were just talking about before. If somebody wants to be an instructor or they already are and they want to help people in this aspect, go learn.
Mm.
Go make yourself more competent to do the job you have. I already have a doctorate. I have a terminal degree. Mm-hmm. I have two other degrees prior to that. Do you think that makes me forever competent in my field? Absolutely not. Mm. I have to continue. Mm. That was just my foundation. That was just the beginning. Mm. Those years and years of student loans and classes and all of that. That was just the beginning. Mm. So I cannot imagine in my mind why anyone would think they're not done learning yet as an instructor. Like go talk to experts in the fields that you're interested in.
Yeah.
Go get your own therapy. Go get, go experience these things. The more you are in denial and have this false sense of self-confidence that, yeah, I can, I can just keep doing what I'm doing and nothing will go wrong. You're always going to have that surprise student one day, if not many of them, who are going to throw you off your game and make you realize you don't know it all.
Mm. What you mentioned earlier in terms of like knowing the context, understanding your population serve them the best way that you can. Now, because most people that start up their own martial arts business, school, they get into it because of the love of the arts, the physical aspect of it, history and all that kind of stuff. But they're not, so they say, oh yeah, when they hear you saying, okay, well, keep on getting the training, keep on getting your CEUs or whatever the equivalent is in martial arts. But the thing is, if they are
if they are putting themselves out there to that they can help certain populations, though that's now part of the context. So maybe part of the context isn't just about the techniques anymore. It's also about the emotional context, the mental context, the, you know, the cultural context that are going to, if not, it's not necessarily going to affect the techniques directly. It's going to affect the performance of them when it's really needed, you know, ultimately. So
yes,
Dr. Megan Horan. Oh my gosh. Listen. People are going to want to get more of you. Absolutely. How can they do that?
Well, I would just say I have a website. It's drmeganhorn.com. But you got to spell Megan right. So it's drmeganhorn.com. And if you go on Facebook or Instagram, it's basically the same thing. You'll find me if you put in Dr. Megan Horn, with the right spelling. So, but yeah, those are the best places to check out. And, I kind of keep that dualistic piece of the therapy side of things and the fight side of things on the website and the social media aspects. And if anyone has any questions, they're welcome to go to any of those avenues. And I have my email address on the website and social media, or, you know, you can just text me through, you know, Instagram or Facebook or whatever. So, yeah, that's where they can get a hold of me.
Dr. Horn, thank you so much. It was a great pleasure.
Thanks for having me.
Well, folks, I hope you appreciated that episode as much as I enjoyed having it. Man, I could have spent another 5 hours talking to Dr. Horn there. There's so much that I think she can lend to this entire conversation in terms of helping women in particular, in terms of, you know, getting them more into self-defense and, you know, self-care along those lines, but also in terms of helping people that have experienced trauma in the past and getting them to be able to deal with that a bit better as well. So I'm a huge fan of Dr. Horn. I'm hoping that I can have her back on and can support her in her future endeavors to try to spread this message as well. But that's it for today's episode, folks. Again, this is Philip with the Everyday Fighter Podcast. Talk to you next time.